done this for a while, and I know that I've gotten a lot of great recommendations from our guests, books that I have enjoyed reading. We talk about history. We talk about science. We talk about social issues, social and political issues. We try to give you things to think about. We give you guests to listen to and sometimes to argue with. And all of that, we think, makes Champaign Urbana a better place to live. We think, at least we hope, that we're making an addition, a positive addition to the community. People have told us that they think that. That's what we really we're all about. And certainly the one thing that we're not all about is trying to make money. It is a nonprofit organization. We're just doing it because... well, this is what we like to do. But again, the bottom line is here, without the listener support, it's not going to happen. So if you have listened to us for a while and have not supported the station for whatever reason, why don't you change that now? Call 244-9455. Yeah. And if you were listening during the first hour, you know that we are offering as a pledge incentive, we will send you a book, brand new hardcover book. You can choose either fiction or nonfiction. And for a basic pledge at the $40 level, or more if you can, we will send you with our thanks a book. And we've done this now for quite a few years at Fun Drive Time. And it's one thing that we found that we can do that gets people excited. And in the past when we've done this, we've given away 20, 30 books, I think. And I'm sure that we can give away some more in this.
And you're giving them away. It is nonprofit. I mean, you're not selling them on eBay, you know?
That's true. Not that we not that we would, of course, do such a thing. No, we
get a good idea.
Sometimes we look at, believe me, sometimes we think, gee, you know, we could say, no. All those books that we get, most of them end up, some of them we give away to people who work here at WILO. We also sometimes send them out to various of the departmental libraries around the university if we have something that we think, you know, for example, the other day I talked to this man who is an amateur archaeologist who says that he believes that he has found Ithaca, the home of Odysseus, and that it's not the place that is called Ithaca today. It's a different place. And he lays out a very convincing and very interesting sort of argument. Mm-hmm. So when we were finished with that show, we sent it to the classics department.
Yeah.
We said, okay, you guys will need this. So sometimes we do that. But this time around, what we're trying to do is use the books to get people to support the station. So that's the offer, $40 pledge or better. Give us a call, 244-9455, and we'll send you a book. Here on the program in this hour, same guys who were here last hour, Kelly Strom, she's the collection manager at the Champaign Public Library. Philip Graham, he's a writer. He's also a professor of English here at the U of I. He teaches young writers, and they both have brought books to recommend. So that's the deal. And if people who are listening, if you'd like to recommend one too, that'd be great. You can call us. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So, next, I think, is Kelly. I think it's your turn again.
All righty. I brought a nonfiction book here, a biography called Jesus Land, a memoir by Julia Shears. The author is a journalist. She's written for such publications as the Los Angeles Times and the San Francisco Chronicle and Wired. And she's written a biography here about her life growing up in rural Indiana. And she is a couple years older than me, so I'd say she's about in her mid-40s now. And when she was young, she had a lot of older brothers and sisters. Her father was a surgeon. Her mother stayed at home, and they were both very interested in their Calvinist church that they attended and were interested in missionary services and giving money to missionaries. And somewhere down the road, they decided they should adopt some kids, and they ended up adopting two African-American boys. And this created, apparently, great havoc in their small rural Indiana town. They grew up near Lafayette, West Lafayette, and... Julia here writes about her experiences with her best friends in life, which were her African-American brothers, and all the teasing and harassment that they received, and a little bit about some of the abuse that they received from her parents. Her parents ultimately decided that they had made a poor choice and actually abused their kids.
Oh, God.
And so she writes about that. And when they were in high school, the one brother is actually the exact same age as Julie is. And when they were in high school, their parents shipped both of them off to a reform school in the Dominican Republic. So the last half of the book is about her experiences at this horrific
God.
But Christian reform school. And basically, they abuse them there. They go through lots of trials and tribulations going through what they call the program, and they're not allowed to go home until they complete the program. Mm-hmm. But I did mark a couple pages here to read before she went to mm-hmm. Dominican Republic. It was back to school time, and they had switched schools. Instead of going to the Christian school that they had been going to, the parents decided to send them to the public school. So they're getting ready to get stuff going for the first day of school. We go to Kmart for our annual trek to buy school clothes, and I hole up in a dressing room with a mound of clothes, hoping to find something that doesn't look like it was bought at Kmart. This is tricky. I choose a few pastel Oxfords and polo shirts, although these have swan icons instead of the trendy alligators and horses, and a pair of plastic penny loafers. I remember this is early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. A pair of fitted paint-splattered jeans gets nixed by my mother when I walk out to model them for her. "What do you want people staring at your butt crack for?" she asks loudly, causing several shoppers to turn in our direction. She walks to a rack of dark denim, grabs two pairs of baggy jeans, and throws them in our cart as I look away, tears stinging my eyes. None of the kids would be caught dead in the Kmart parking lot, but Mother views blue light specials as manna from heaven. Polyester slacks, two pairs for $10. We can outfit the entire family. Reduced for quick sale toothpaste, we'll stock up for the next 5 years. Our family shops at Kmart for the same reason we drink instant milk and eat garbage soup and use dish detergent for bubble bath. We're cheap. Mother still hasn't gotten over the Great Depression. I know that if I complain about my school clothes, I'll be subjected to stories about how her family was forced to eat withered apples from her father's general store in Corsica, and how she left for college with only two flower sack dresses to her name. Shame on you. You don't know how good you have it. I'd just as soon stick my hand in a vat of boiling oil than hear it once more. Mother says money we save by being frugal helps the cause of missionaries around the world, but it certainly doesn't help mine. Once again, I'll be the dorky girl at school. My only hope is that to find more babysitting jobs so I can acquire enough money to go shopping at the Tippecanoe Mall like a normal person. In the men's department, David, that's her her brother, that's the same age as she is, David greets us cradling an armload of satin basketball jerseys emblazoned with Big Ten logos, Purdue, Michigan, and then Notre Dame. He looks at Mother with wide-eyed mixture of hope and apprehension, and she shakes her head and strides to a table piled with T-shirts. Colored Hanes, $2.99. Mother scoops several into the shopping cart. David hugs the shimmering jerseys to his chest. "What's wrong with these?" he asks, alarm rising in his face. I look at him and roll my eyes. I was 3 years old when my mother told me I was getting a baby brother. When she said, "your baby brother," I assumed he'd be mine and mine alone, and swelled with self-importance. I would no longer be the baby of the family. I, too, would have someone to boss around. A crib was placed in an upstairs bedroom, and I'd check it several times a day, peering between the slats to see if my baby had arrived. Time after time, I was heartbroken by the empty mattress. "Baby here today?" I'd ask Mother. "Soon," was always the reply. The day he arrived, on March 17, 1970, I was in the basement, lost in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. The older kids were at school. After the show ended, I went into the kitchen for a butter and sugar sandwich, and Mother hushed me. My baby brother was sleeping, she said, and I was not to disturb him. I waited until she started washing the dishes before creeping upstairs on my hands and knees. The door to his room was closed, and I paused on the threshold, listening to pots banging against the sink before pushing the door inward. The sun streamed through yellow curtains as I approached the crib on tiptoes, breathing hard. Finally, inside, it was my baby doll asleep. I stared in awe at his molasses-colored skin. Nobody told me that my baby would be brown. I pressed my face between the slats and marveled at him, at the chalky trails of dried tears crisscrossing his face, at his size. He looked much smaller than I was, although he was only 4 months younger. He was my baby, and I had to touch him. I reached between the slats and poked his arm with a finger, too hard. His eyes flipped open, big and brown and watery scared, and I snatched my hand back. His bottom lip started to quiver. "Shh, baby, shh," I whispered. "Don't cry." I glanced behind me at the open door. Mother would paddle me if she caught me disobeying. But my baby didn't make a noise. He just watched me with those big brown eyes, waiting to see what I'd do next. I reached back into the crib and touched the black fuzz on his head, gently this time. "It's okay, baby," I whispered. I kept my hand on him until the long fringes of his eyelids drifted shut and he fell back to sleep.
Beautiful.
So that's kind of characteristic of the relationship the two of them have throughout their lives, at home dealing with the abuse and the harassment at school, and then at this reform school, which I think still exists today in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah. The list of the books that we're talking about, I want to mention one more time and then we'll talk with some people who are listening. The list of the books that our guests, Philip Graham and Kelly Strom, have recommended are on the website, our website, wyll.uiuc.edu. Or if you don't have web access, we can get you a book list. If you'd like to call and recommend something, you can do that. And I have several people here who would like to talk with us, so let's talk with them. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we'll start with somebody in Chicago. Line number four. Hello.
Hello. That last book sounds really interesting. I wanted to recommend a mystery writer, Michael Pierce, who has two really wonderful series. The first one is, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, they're The Mysteries of the Mamour Zap. And the Mamour Zap was like the head of the secret police in Ottoman Egypt, and the series takes place at the end of the 19th century, and right now he's got it, the last book, which came out in 2005, it's just at the beginning of World War One, and he, the hero is the Mamour Zap, who's a Welshman, and he is, in each story, he's trying to solve or keep the political tensions at an even keel, and the whole book is about his creativeness. The stories are always his creativeness of how he solves the problem. And he just has a wonderful feel of the author. Michael Pierce grew up in Anglo-Sudan. So he really knows the area. And he also has just a wonderful sense of humor. So they're very funny. They're short and they're very funny. And at the same time, they're very human. I think that if you liked Alexander McCall, you'll probably also like this. And he just started a new series where he focuses on, it takes place about 1911, and his hero is a man named Seymour. And in each case, his heroes are always someone who's not quite the in crowd. Like the Mamour Zap is Welsh. He wasn't part of the Oxford-Cambridge crowd, and that's one reason why he wasn't comfortable in the Indian Army. In this case, Seymour is the son of immigrants. His parents, his grandfather's Polish, his mother is Hungarian. And so as he works in the British Foreign Service, he doesn't quite fit in. And so his heroes are always people that are between the two worlds that they're involved in, and as a result, they become a bridge. And he's just a wonderful writer, and I hope more people read his books. He only has two books in the last series. The last series, the series with Seymour, I think that the point of it is people in the diplomatic service who get a feeling that World War One is about to happen, and they're trying to put out the fires, but they do it on their own, and they end up dead. And he's always being sent from London to investigate the deaths, and so there seems to be this pattern in the two books that he has in the series so far. But they're just wonderful books. They're hilariously funny, which is unusual at this time. And I think especially the book, the Mamour Zap book, when I first read it, I thought, oh, I bet this is what Paul Wolfowitz was reading, because in all of the stories, you get the impression of Britain is in the background but controlling this country as they lead it towards, in this case, it was civilization, and in Egypt they were trying to bring it to economic solvency. And you just get the feeling that all the neocons were reading these books, and this is what they thought would happen when they went into Iraq. They'd have this wonderful controller, and there would be, you know, the Egyptian front, and then they'd be the American behind, in this case, the Iraqi front. And it's sort of...
Well, if they were reading fiction and starting a war, they should have been reading some different books.
that's the only thing I think they could have been reading that they thought it would work, because obviously it worked for the British for a short time. Mm. But They're very funny and they're very worthwhile.
Great.
And
sounds
his
like
last
an
name is Pierce, P-E-A-R-C-E.
Great. Thank you.
Great. Well, I appreciate the recommendation.
You're welcome.
We did, in fact, have somebody call in a little bit earlier off the air saying they would like to hear any recommendations for mystery or science fiction books. So
okay,
there we have some.
That's a terrific mystery, and there's almost 15 books in the Memoir Zap series, so they'll be entertained for some time.
And keep you busy for a while.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Can I just say, in terms of science fiction, I haven't read the book yet, but I just purchased it yesterday. There's a wonderful writer in town today and yesterday, Kelly Link. Her first book of short stories, Stranger Things Happen, is a wonderful book of kind of science fiction-y fantasy ghost stories, and it's literary too, but they're absolutely and utterly infected. You know, you're addictive to read. And her new book, which he read from yesterday at the university, is called Magic for Beginners. And she read a wonderful story yesterday. And I think anybody who likes science fiction or that kind of writing will really, really love Kelly Link's work.
Okay, very good. Let's talk with someone in Belgium, not the country, but the town here, line number one.
We don't go that far out, do we?
Hello.
Yes, hello. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hello.
Okay. The last caller was talking about a mystery about World War One, or about that time. And that just reminded me of, I forget the guy who wrote it, but it was called The Bandy Papers, and these were written in the early to mid-70s, I believe. And there was like Volume 1, Volume 2, Volume 3.
It was written by a guy named Donald Jack.
That's right. That's right. He's English, right?
You should pardon the expression, Amazon website, and I just put in the name and it came up with the titles, and it looks like, it looks like there are several books by the same writer that all have to do with this particular character, I guess. His name is Bartholomew Bandy.
That's right.
Right? Okay. There are quite a few. Okay. Yeah, tell us about it. What?
It's just real funny. It's just really, really funny. I would recommend that to anybody.
Okay.
I don't know how to describe that.
Are they mystery?
No, they're dealing with. It's kind of like a situation comedy or. Madcap adventures of this guy who's winds up flying a plane in World War One, and he's a real out. Well, he's not an outcast, but he's just a misfit. They're just really good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, great. Well, Senator, it looks like they're historical novels.
Yeah.
They're humorous.
Yeah.
And they're all about the misadventures of a particular. You would call that picaresque. Yeah. I think I was actually paying attention that day in English class, the adventures of the sort of humorous misadventures of one person who finds himself in.
Yeah.
A lot of different situations and maybe manages to get by just by the skin of his teeth.
That's right.
He's maybe not exactly a hero, but sometimes ends up acting like one.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Bandy Papers.
And also, okay, basically what I called was, I just started reading a week ago, is John D. MacDonald.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How are you enjoying that?
Real good. This particular book, Five Complete Travis McGee Novels.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these I read back in the early 70s, but for some, the Travis McGee character is this, I don't think he's not a detective, but he's just kind of this hard-boiled character, mm-hmm. kind of.
And you're rereading those?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Getting something new out of them now.
And I'm, yeah, yeah, Yeah.
Great.
It's like watching a movie after 20 years.
That's right.
You pick up something new.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thanks for the recommendations.
That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very good.
All right,
we'll go on here, and we'll talk again with somebody else. And the next person is back here in Urbana, and line number two. Hello.
Here's a science fiction recommendation for you.
Great.
This is the author is Alastair Reynolds. He's British, mm-hmm. and he is a bona fide scientist. And he's I'm reading the third of four novels that the Urbana Library has. The titles are Revelation Space, Chasm City, Redemption Arc, and Absolution Gap. Mm-hmm. And they're original, fascinating, and creepy.
Oh,
creepy.
And
I do.
And that's why I read science fiction in the first place. It's like a lifelong project. And of course, each author creates their own science fiction universe, mm-hmm. and that's not for the faint of heart.
Oh.
His is centuries in the future, and there are hardly any references to dear old Earth here. It's all in the future, and the technology is far, far advanced.
Mm-hmm.
And
do the characters all have odd names that are hard to pronounce?
Actually, not really.
Oh, good. Okay. Because I sometimes have a problem.
A fellow named Clavian in this novel. Another guy named Scorpio, who is an intelligent pig rather than being a human.
Oh.
Yeah. And then there's the bizarre ultras who fly the Lighthugger spaceships that go close to the speed of light and are truly, truly strange. Mm. If the pig isn't strange enough. But now his concept of the weird melding plague is really creepy.
Mm.
He's just starting, I think.
Okay.
So somebody called in for science fiction. I got another book in a completely different genre to recommend too.
Okay.
And that is a book called Orin Babes in Beijing by Rachel DeWoskin. Now, I heard her interviewed on NPR. I missed Celeste Quinn's interview with her. It is a riot, autobiographical, cross-cultural a life of the author in China about 10 years ago at a time when she was hired to be an actress on a Chinese soap opera named Foreign Babes in Beijing. And the thing is, it's brings the difference in the ways of thinking down to a real personal level.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can read the book, say, China Incorporated by Ted Fishman, and get the economic and governmental challenges that China poses are pretty well laid out. But this is this young woman's personal experience over there, and it's funny in many places and tragic in a few others.
Okay,
yeah.
That's great.
Did you?
I read another book by Alistair Reynolds that I also picked up at the library, a book called Century Rain. Have you read that?
No, I hadn't noticed it in the Urbana Library, but thanks for the tip.
It's an interesting combination of a detective noir and science fiction.
Hey,
and I don't know if you would like, but if you liked his other books, you might like that too. I liked it.
By the way, did you ever read any by Catherine Azzaro?
I haven't. Kelly's nodding.
Oh, okay.
Her head.
Combination of science fiction and red hot romance.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nope, mm-hmm. There isn't.
All right.
That's my two cents for this morning.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks for the suggestions.
Thank you.
We're about at a midpoint here. And before we go any further, we need to give away some more books, and we need to get some people to call and give us some money. That's really what we're having a good time here this morning, and that's all well and good. But this is one of the very few times that we interrupt the programs at all. The rest of the time, we're doing the show. But a couple times a year, we need to remind people just how important their financial support is for the station and try to find as many different ways as we can to get people to call and make a pledge and send us some money. And here on this program this morning, the way that we have is we have books. We're giving away books, well, sort of giving them away. We're actually asking people to make a pledge. But if they do, we'll send him a book. 244-9455 is the number to call to make a pledge. Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me. He's our web guru. He doesn't like it when we say stuff like that, but he's the guy who's really responsible for
the book giver
for
aware.
Taking care of
that's
our
right.
website.
Yes.
And well, in this particular case, yeah, I guess that's right.
That's right. Well, this is something we call Crazy Dave and Jack's Amazing Book Giveaway, and it's something we like to do because we love books, and we like to share them. We have so many darn books that we just can't even shake a stick at them all. So please help us out with a pledge call right now to 217-244-9455, and we'll give you either a fiction, hardcover fiction, or hardcover nonfiction. You can choose the category, but these are all grade A Focus 580 approved books. We'll send them your way. Personally pick them for you by Dave and Jack and Harriet also, and perhaps Martha as well. We'll all have fun doing that. But we have these books, and we really want to each pledge at the basic membership level of $40, we'll send you a free book. 217-244-9455. And David Teal is our TV program director. How's it going in Pledge Central, Dave? Sounds a little quiet.
It is quiet at the moment. We've given away 9 books this morning, so that's good.
We're going for 20.
But yeah, we're going for 20. We've got a lot more than that sitting around here. So we'd love to get rid of some books. We'd love to give them to you when you call us right now at 217-244-9455 and make a pledge at the $40 level or higher. You can choose a fiction or a nonfiction book. So that's, a way of helping to support the station. And, I think it's important to remind people that this program that we do this morning, I mean, this is something that doesn't have to be on the air. You know, you could just turn on the pipeline. You know, you could turn on the receiver from NPR and you could get, some kind of program. But you guys produce, 2 hours of live programming every morning, and I've done it a few times here. I've done a few episodes of Focus, and it's a lot of work.
It absolutely is a lot of work. And Dave actually reads all those books.
Yeah. Don't tell people that.
You do. You do. I know. I know you do. And actually, I'm amazed that, you're talking about going to the library to pick up more books just reading for fun. This guy's basically reading all the time. And I know that when I'm sitting in for David as well, it's a very high standard to uphold. And, I try to read as much as I possibly can. And that's the kind of show this is. And it's not something that exists very many places, actually. A show like Focus 580, it's kind of a rare flower. So, we're asking you to help support the ecosystem that keeps that flower growing. Actually, we really do count on you for our financial support. Almost half our budget comes from your contributions, and this is one of those times when we make that happen, and you can make that happen by calling 217-244-9455.
Well, thank you very much.
And we'll send you a book.
And I promise, metaphor abuse, I'm glad Jack Brighton here has come
through.
Thank you.
I do what I can.
All right. Our guests here this morning on the program, Kelly Strom and Philip Graham. Kelly is the collection manager at the Champaign Public Library. Philip is a writer and also teaches at the U of I. And every once in a while, people like them are here on the program to recommend books, to suggest things that you might like to read. And as you have heard, people who are listening can do that too if you want to call us, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Otherwise, we'll carry on here for about the next 20 minutes or so. Philip?
Yes. Kelly read from a memoir. I think I'll do the same thing. This is actually a memoir by a poet, August Kleinzahler. It's called Cuddy One Rock. And it's Low Characters and Strange Places Gently Explained. Mm. And August Kleinzahler grew up with a very odd family. And they lived in New Jersey, right across from New York City. They lived on the edges of the mafia neighborhoods. And so there's some very interesting stories about that. But this wonderful opening to the book called The Dog, The Family, A Household Tale, starts it off. It was the dog who raised me. Oh, the others came and went with their nurturing gestures and concerns. But it was the dog on whose ear I teethed and who watched me through countless hours with sagacity. We called him Granny or Grand, shortened from 20 Grand, the famous racehorse after whom he was named. Father bought him on sale. He bought everything on sale. Grand was a boxer, purebred, but one of his ears was wrong. It didn't set up properly, and his right eye dripped. He also had a skin condition, something like mange, but untreatable. Father got him for peanuts, really. A treasure, if you looked past certain cosmetic flaws. Granny was a killer, but only when off the leash out of doors. He killed the chihuahua next door and Ernie Middlehauser's dog, Jojo. He seldom attacked humans, only dogs, male dogs. Female dogs brought out his romantic side. You see, if you weren't careful, when you opened the front or back door, he would shoot by you or between your legs and be gone for days. Eventually, he'd turn up hungry, looking a bit haggard. Father would kick him for a while until he tired of the exercise. And Granny would take it stoically, without growling or baring his teeth, only looking back at Father now and then with an ugly sneer. Mother didn't like children. Least of all her own, and me least among them. I was unplanned, an accident, a misfortune. You see, Mother and Father had taken the Fishblats, their friends from around the corner, out for dinner, and everybody got quite drunk. That had been my parents' plan, to get the Fishblats drunk. It seems the Fishblats were making ready for a divorce, which signaled no more impromptu get-togethers, only a hop, skip, and jump away. I suppose the plan was that when the appropriate level of drunkenness was achieved, there would be a series of ribald and stoical jokes about the imperfect union of marriage, hoots of exasperation and unbridled guffaws, and the Fishblats would stagger home, enjoy an amorous reconciliation of robust proportion, and resign themselves to being stuck with one another for the duration, a circumstance relieved from time to time by visits with my parents. Well, now, it didn't turn out like that. The Fishblats sobered up straight away and got divorced. Mother became pregnant with me, years after she convinced herself she'd beaten that particular rap. My appearance on the scene was unwelcome enough, but it turned out that I looked like the dog. I am not suggesting that Mother had been impregnated by Granny, not at all. You see, if Mother had only listened to her own mother and averted her eyes from the dog during the term of her pregnancy, it was said this unhappy result might have been avoided.
Very good.
Wow.
Cuddy
One Rock, Low Characters and Strange Places Gently Explained by August Kleinsaler.
All right. On the website, look for the titles and the authors, wyll.uiuc.edu.
I've got another one.
You've got another one.
I've got a fiction one here for those of you craving some fiction. This I've read a few times, and it's ending up to be kind of, each time I read it, as we were talking earlier, I kind of get more out of it, and it's becoming one of my favorites. It's called The Handyman, that's all one word, and it's by Carolyn C., S-E-E, and it's kind of confusing. It first starts out because it starts out as a college student applying for a Guggenheim Fellowship to do some research on an artist, and then it starts into the story. And as it turns out, the artist that he wanted to do the research on is the character in the story when he was quite a bit younger. And he goes to Paris thinking he's going to be this world-famous artist, and he's very discouraged and only stays a few days, and then comes home and decides, well, I guess I'll just enroll at the local college and take some classes and see what I can do, and decides to earn some money being a handyman. Well, as it turns out, he touches so many lives in this job and fixes not only what's wrong around their house, but fixes some of the things that are going wrong within themselves, and becomes a lifesaver to so many people, while at the same time painting and just bringing joy to different facets of their lives. And it's fascinating to me. I just love reading the description of him painting and the colors he chooses, and the change that takes place among the people that he's working for. And so I have a little bit here I was going to read. He got a call as a handyman to go to a house, and he didn't know quite yet when he got there what it would be like, but he quickly finds out that there's chaos ensuing at this house by a young mother and her three children. There is a snake that's loose in the house, and it's trying to eat a rabbit, and they're all kind of freaking out about this. And once he takes care of the rabbit and the snake, he says, So what is the problem here? Why is it that you needed to call me? And the mother says, I got a little behind. Michael says there's no excuse that I don't work outside the home, so it ought to be easy. But I'd like to see him try it. There's only me. There's only me. She began tuning up to cry again. It's those kids. They don't give me any help. They don't give me any respect. I can't do it. I won't do it. They can do it anything they want to me, but they can't make me do it. The room we were standing in had about 2 feet of dirty clothes on the floor, wall to wall. I bent down, picked up an armload, opened the washer, jammed the clothes in. Not exactly handyman work, but what the heck. Detergent, I asked, do you have some around? I don't know. I found some on a shelf and started the washer. $10 an hour, I said, and I got here at 2. I went to the kitchen, which was a shambles. Dishwasher? I saw it as I was talking and began loading up. There was so much junk and stuff around the dirty dishes and old food on the sink and on the center counter island that I didn't have to move to load. I just reached and reached and reached. Filled the machine, found the other detergent, started it up. I began at one end of the kitchen, clearing the way, putting dead food down the garbage disposal. I ran hot water in a bowl, poured in some Clorox, found a sponge, and began wiping my way inch by inch down the long counters. Hugh and Samantha came in and watched. Make yourself useful, will you guys? Bring in the dishes from the dining room. Stay away from that snake now. They looked at me like they'd been debrained. Then they turned around to get some dishes. Put them on one of the counters, any counter. That's cool. So he continues doing all this work in the kitchen, and he starts talking to the mom. He says, what's your first name, Mrs. Walker? Jamie. So, Jamie, what's the problem? I didn't look at her. I kept my attention down on the sink. I asked her again, what's the problem? How long has it been like this? Ever since, I can't be the only one, she said. Can't be the only one what? There isn't any. I came upon a dish of what looked like Stouffer's spinach souffle, something my mother used to fix for herself, but it was actually a dish of mold. I put it down the disposal. What? A reason to live. She was maybe 40. Her wild eyes were very bright blue. Her skin looked tight and tan. She'd probably had a lift. I don't think I'd ever seen a sadder face in my life. Jamie, don't feel bad. I put my arm around her and patted her shoulder. Hugh and Samantha stared at us, goggle-eyed. You kids, keep those dishes coming. Are you divorced or something? Business trip. Michael's coming back tomorrow, and that's why I called you. But that's not it. There's no reason for me to. Don't think about it now. Why don't you go and look in the fridge and hand me any bad food you see? Okay, you kids, go upstairs and see if there's any more dirty dishes up there. When's Mr. Walker coming back? I said, tomorrow, around noon, I think. I work for 5 hours steady. I set Samantha to folding laundry and sent Hugh, who gave me a certain amount of lip, out to mow the lawn. At about 5, I could look around the kitchen to decide that it was clean enough. My hands were Clorox-soaked and wrinkled. I felt as tired and crabby as any housewife. Mrs. Walker hadn't been good for much. She sat at the table and watched me the whole time, sniffling a little and rubbing her eyes. So that's just a little bit about his experiences. And that little excerpt didn't talk as much about his painting, but the book is so beautifully written on his skills in so many different areas that it's just a joy to read.
She teaches poet? English.
Yes.
She teaches at
UCLA.
And I don't know, maybe people, she's apparently written a book that's a book about writing that's titled Making a Literary Life. At first I was thinking there's also another writer, a writer named Lisa C., who has written novels, and also she's a Chinese American, and she's written a book about her family history, a book on Gold Mountain, which I know sold very well and was well received. And the two women are probably not related at all, but somehow I thought.
I think they are. There's a brief description on her, and I think sisters? She has a sister.
Okay. Maybe so. They are related. I know Celeste has talked a couple of times with Lisa about some of the things that she has.
It says her family, Lisa C.
Oh, okay. Well, very good. Right. Well, they're sisters. All right. We can do at least one more. Okay. We'll have time for it.
Right.
Yeah.
This is a new book by another new colleague, Leanne Howe, a book of poems and prose called Evidence of Red. Leanne Howe is a Native American writer. And the thing that I love about this book is that it's got a little bit of everything in it. It's got like a play, and it's got stories and appears to be nonfiction and poems and everything.
Somebody's
else.
Headphones are feeding
oh,
back.
Sorry. I'll move back a little bit here. I'd like to read a couple of these poems.
I think the offender here actually was Kelly. Oh. She was too close to the
microphone. She looks embarrassed.
To the microphone. Yeah.
this is a lovely poem called Postmortem, and it's a poem that also is about the dream life, too, as well as family life and her father. Postmortem. The things we do in our sleep. Father's Day, 1977. You drive a Jeep Cherokee into my dreams and park, just like a cliché. I hold the Mickey Mouse tie I once bought for you but boxed up instead of mailing. We cry. On the day you die in 1997, my mother will telephone. I am teaching school in Northfield, Minnesota, but recollect nothing more except her call. It's odd the things we claim in moments when our lips are sealed. A lost tie, the father I didn't know, but feel like sinew and muscle. Now in our sleep we lash memory to membrane, grafting echoes into harmony, and we smile posthumously. She also has a series of poems about the noble savage. My name is Noble Savage, and Disney's Pocahontas longs for Noble Savage. This one is Noble Savage Sees a Therapist. Noble Savage, she's too intense for me. I feel nothing, no emotion. In fact, I'm off all females. Even lost my lust for attacking white chicks. Pause. Therapist, he writes furiously on a yellow pad but says nothing. Noble Savage, people expect me to be strong, wise, stoic, without guilt. A man capable of a few symbolic acts. Ugh. Is that what I'm supposed to say? Therapist, he continues writing. Noble Savage. I don't feel like maiming, scalping, burning wagon trains. I'm developing hemorrhoids from riding bareback. It's an impossible role. The truth is I'm conflicted. I don't know who I am. What should I do, Doc? Therapist. I'm afraid we've run out of time. Let's take this up on our next visit. And then the very next one, the Indian sports mascot meets Noble Savage. Indian mascot. I always think of us as a couple. Noble Savage. Have we ever been together? Are we ever going to be? Indian mascot. But here we are. You with a bow and arrow. Me in a headdress. Noble Savage. We've never been together. Indian mascot. Do you dream of us? Noble Savage. No. Indian mascot, I do. And when I do, you look just like me.
Very good.
Leanne Howe.
Very good.
Evidence of Red, Poems and Prose.
Very good. Just for the record, by the way, Carolyn and Lisa C. are not sisters. Lisa, this data comes from Jason Croft, who's at the board. Lisa C. is Carolyn C.'s daughter.
Oh.
They're not sisters.
But they're related.
Yeah. They are related.
Close.
But I just want
to.
I was the one who said.
Said
I was.
Okay.
I said sisters. Oh, actually, thanks to Celeste Quinn for the information, because she was the one who actually has talked with Lisa. So she's the one who actually.
Very good.
She's the one who actually knows.
Yeah.
We sometimes say things we don't really know. Mm-hmm. But I'm a talk show host and I'm entitled. We're almost at the point where we have to finish up. I don't know. Do you want to? One or the other of you can go one more round.
Well, we can do some quickie things here. I have a book here called From Altoids to Zima, and it's the surprising stories behind 125 famous brand names. So I've selected a few here.
Books like that.
One of them, Pringles. Anybody know how Pringles got their name? Well,
I'm afraid to ask. Good
says,
story.
Well, one thing's for certain. It was a lot cheaper than hiring some fancy naming consultant, and it seems to have worked. Casting around for a name for their new potato snack product in the late 1960s, the marketing folks at Procter & Gamble had a thought. Instead of trying to dream up a completely new name, why not take a close look at the names that already exist? So they pulled out the phone book for their hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio, and started browsing. Sometime later, exactly how much later is not recorded, but Cincinnati is a pretty big town. They hit the jackpot. Tucked away in the suburb of Finneytown, they found a street named Pringle Avenue. Pringle, potato, that's it. Pringles, potato, snack product. No, wait, let's call them crisps. And so perfectly round Pringles, potato, crisps hit America's streets in 1968, neatly stacked in a distinctive cylindrical metal can.
Wow, from a street in Cincinnati.
Because there are people, I think, who make their living just coming up with names of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Just like that, because you obviously can't be something that already exists in the name world. So it costs you big money. But then if you just, Cincinnati phone book,
there you go. There you go. So this book is full of all different companies ranging from Bacardi to Xerox to Barbie to Hallmark.
Oh, so
lots of ideas.
Okay.
Would you like to read another?
Yes, another new colleague. I have a lot of new colleagues that are in the creative writing program. This is not a new book, but a newish book by Rigoberto Gonzalez. It's a novel. He's also a poet. He also writes creative nonfiction, children's literature, and biographies. This is the novel called Crossing Vines, and it's a novel that's wonderfully structured. I don't know if I have time to read a long section. I know I don't, but I just want to talk a little bit about the structure. It starts out with a whole every chapter is rather short, and it starts in like 3 a.m. when people are getting ready to go to work in the fields, picking grapes for the big landowners, and you get a sense. Then it goes to 4:45, then 6:20, 8:15, and so forth. And it's in one day in the life of a number of people who work in these fields. And you get to know them very well. You see their interactions. You learn a lot about them. There's a lot of information about their secrets and so forth. And it's a wonderful novel. Just you learn so much about the people who are working there. And it's also it's kind of people here, they talk in a way that I can't say over the radio. But one of the things I like very much here is this is Doña Ramona. This is 8:35 a.m. Manuel was working with a pair of eyes, a pair of hands, a tight-lipped mouth, and no ears. He's deaf, but he doesn't have his hearing aid on. He doesn't want to hear anything. Not much disrupted the mechanical way he packed the grapes into the shipping boxes, except a bee buzzing around his line of vision, and even then only when it finally landed on the rim of his hat. Doña Ramona watched him weave the quick, swatting motion into the rhythm of his hands. She felt shooed away herself when she asked twice, "Do you want some more water in your canteen or something?" And he kept at his task in front of the shaky packing table. She turned to Doña Gertrudis in her orange hard hat, making her way back to the end of the row. She was still within earshot, but she didn't feel like raising her voice, so Doña Ramona decided to wait until their next shipment dropped to get water. A few steps forward, she glanced at the pocket watch around her neck and changed her mind, turning back toward the avenue subversively without her best friend and without her husband, the pocket watch dangling from her neck pressed against her chest like a medal. And although this act startled her at first, she liked the taste of it and washed it down with the first gulp of water from the tank. Chela and Francisca came up behind Doña Ramona. Chela surprised her with a sharp jab in her side with the handle tips of the clippers. "Leave some for us, Doña," Chela said, and she sat on the lowered tailgate to take her drink. "Is that how you spend the day, behaving like a water pipe?" Doña Ramona said. "I don't understand you, Ramoncita," Francisca said. "You know," Doña Ramona said, sucking it in through one end and then flushing it out through the other. "Doña Ramona," Chela said, giggling uncontrollably. "I didn't know your clippers were that sharp."
Very good. Well,
Crossing Vines for Rigoberto Gonzalez.
The titles and the authors on the website, wyll.uiuc.edu. If you want to go back and look at any of these books, go to the bookstore, go to the library, read. We believe in this. This is very good. Like we believe in writers, books, and librarians. We love librarians.
Oh, yeah.
And our guest this morning, Philip Graham, he teaches at U of I and has written some pretty good stuff himself. So if you'd like for something to read, you might look for his novel, How to Read an Unwritten Language.
Thank you.
That I think was a very good book.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
And Kelly is collection manager of the Champaign Public Library. So looking for some books, go to the library. Ask the librarians.
His book that he wrote with his wife is one of my favorite books of all time.
Oh, thank you.
Parallel Worlds?
Yes.
Also a very good book. Very good. All right. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Before we find ourselves out of time and having to hand off to the Afternoon Magazine, one more time, we want to make the pitch for people to call in, make a pledge,
and get a book. Jack Brighton is here.
244-9455 with your basic membership pledge, $40 or more if you want, $25 for senior citizens and students as well, and people on fixed incomes. You will get a hardcover first edition book, either fiction or nonfiction. You choose the category. That's about the best we can do because there's so many darn books. We can't list titles. 244-9455. We had, I think last time I checked, maybe 13 or 14 calls during Focus 580. We wanted to get to 20. So let's check in with David Thiel in our Pledge Center and see how we're doing on that goal of 20 calls during Focus this morning.
Well, see, now you stole my thunder there because that's what I was going to say. We're at 13. We're working toward 20. Now I have nothing to talk about other than the fact that, you know.
Come on.
Yeah, well, you know. And
we did a good show, didn't we?
Come on. You guys did, and you know, always, of course, a great job here on Focus. I mean, and as I said before, I mean, when I've filled in on
always.
This,
yeah.
Most of the time.
Yeah,
so,
most
of the time. It takes a lot of
the averages are good, you know.
You do have to read those books, and I've read, you know, some of those books really aren't that exciting. So, you know, it's
wait
just
a
like,
minute.
I'm just, no, not the books
sell
I'm talking
it,
about
Dave.
Today. I'm just saying, occasionally, a book you have to read for Focus, I would bet, is not very exciting.
Right. Okay, well, let's get some excitement with the phones ringing, folks. 217-244-9455. We need 7 calls in the next, 3 minutes? We can do that. Also, you can go to our website, willpledge.org, make a pledge there, and you can make a note whether you'd like a fiction or a nonfiction book right there on the website. So willpledge.org or 217-244-9455. Make the call to support the show, the station, and get a book.
All right. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Funds for this day of broadcasting also come in part from a contribution by Frieda Birnbaum in honor of her husband, Howard, on the date of his birth. There, we got to leave it. We'll hand things off to Celeste Quinn, a literary gal, if there ever was one. And she is the host of the Afternoon Magazine.
I am.
She'll be with you for the rest of the afternoon. And you're going to have a storyteller on
the
show.
Yeah, the stories are going to continue this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Award-winning storyteller and singer Dan Ketting will be our guest. He's the author of the book Stories of Hope and Spirit, Folk Tales from Eastern Europe. He's also recorded a number of CDs, including the Gypsy Wagon Tales from the neighborhood. He joins us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at what is happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat is trading at 329.5, down 6.75. March, 344, down 7.25. December corn, 202, down 1.75. March, 214.75, down 1.75. May corn, 222.5, down 2. December, 247.5, down 1. November beans, excuse me, November soybeans trading at 5.